Good morning, diners and travelers, on this nice, hot summer day. Good morning, Rabbit.
Good morning, good morning. It is a nice, hot summer day.
I like hot summer days.
Yeah, I know you like hot summer days. I was watching the golf earlier on today. It was 62 degrees and absolutely pouring down with the wind at 25 knots. And the guys are still playing golf because they're tough sweats. Well, what are we going to do today? Today, we have a number of different views of what it is that's important you should know about if you're approaching cooking and your diet.
If there's a
common thread to the program, that's it. It's going to range from comfort food to how you butcher it, or how you might actually go catch it first before you butcher it. Just an all over the place kind of program, but starting out with a subject that's we always have a fondness for, and I think Americans in general have a fondness for, and that's comfort food. A new take on comfort food by James Osland, who's the editor-in-chief
of
Sevura magazine, and a very knowledgeable fellow. And he's got comfort food, but comfort food from a rather different perspective, as you'll hear when you listen to him talk
good
to
book.
Us.
James Osland. Is it Osland or Osland, James?
Usually say Osland.
Okay. Last time we interviewed you, it was Cradle of Flavor, I believe, which is wild.
That's absolutely right. I remember it well.
Yeah.
About six years ago.
But you were editor-in-chief of one of our favorite magazines, Sevura, and boy, you get to do a lot of traveling as a result of that.
Right? A lot of traveling, but not, to tell you the truth, not anywhere near as much as I would do if I had my own druthers. I just cannot go away as often as I used to before I took the job as editor-in-chief, nor for as long a trip.
Oh, you have to be back.
Have to get back in the office. The sort of maximum trip I can take is 2.5-3 weeks. But I love those 6 months kind of trips.
Oh, yeah. I guess
yeah,
we all
not
do.
Not now.
Well, anyhow, we're going to be discussing your latest book, Sevura, The New Comfort Food, Home Cooking from Around the World. And it is one gloriously photographed book, I have to say.
Oh, thank you very much.
And tell us a little bit about this book. You had a reason for most of these recipes had been already published in Sevura?
Most of them have. That's correct. Sevura has done well with this one, 4 books. There were 3 books in the past, one focusing on Italian food, another on French, and another on American classics. And it had been a number of years, about 8 or 9 years, in fact, since Sevura had done a book. And so we thought it was high time to do another. And we, meaning the editorial staff at the office, sat around and talked about what that next book might be. And in our conversations, the words comfort and food just kept on coming up unconsciously. And the more conscious we got about those two words, comfort food, we realized the way that we perceive comfort food has changed so much, especially in the last 2 decades or so.
In what way?
Truly, it's no longer just the mashed potatoes and the meatloaf, and it is still those things, but it's so much more than those things now. And I don't think that it's just particular to us at Sevura magazine. I guess I mean really more of a kind of American we. I think Americans are just much more global diners than they were 20 years ago. And a Thai style curry or a, you know, really truly classic French dish, I think these foods are very much in our vernacular these days. These are the foods that we crave when we want comfort, when we really want to be grounded and feel this great, wonderful quality of joy when we eat.
Started craving some of these things because I haven't had them in a long time. As I said to you, I think that the food police would not be thrilled with this book.
I kind of say to hell with the food police, even though I do try my best to police my own diet as much as I possibly can. These are not foods necessarily about that. They're not the most healthy foods on the face of the planet to eat.
Fettuccine Alfredo's in here.
Fettuccine Alfredo with, I think it's basically just 3 ingredients. It's the fettuccine, the Parmesan cheese, a lot of it, and butter. A lot of it. But But, you know, these foods are just so important, I think, to eat because they are so joy-making. And I think, as with anything, the key is moderation.
Yeah, fried, deep-fried catfish.
Oh, no problem with
chicken
that.
Chicken-fried steak. Yeah, I mean, you have it all in here.
These are what we might call robust flavors.
They're certainly.
They're not for the faint of heart. And that's exactly the purpose, I guess. I mean, there's something wholly restorative about having something that reminds you of your roots and takes you back to the tastes of childhood or adulthood with family or whatever it is. I mean, that's what comfort foods are all about.
Macaroni and cheese with ham. But, you know, I might say it really is good macaroni and cheese with ham.
Oh, it is.
Okay, yeah, I mean, you've used fresh herbs, sharp cheddar, you know, it's blue cheese. Fresh herbs. I mean, it's really different.
Well, I think you point out something that I think that one thing that these are all these great direct-to-the-heart dishes, but we've given recipes here for really, I mean, I believe, honestly, very good versions of these foods. There's not a lot of junk and chemical crap, and there's no shortcuts. Even, for instance, we have a green bean casserole.
Yeah, I saw that classic
that classic Thanksgiving dish, and there's none of, you know,
none of that pop open the
cream of mushroom soup thing. Just make a very, very simple bechamel, and bechamel is a very simple thing to make, and deep fry your own onions rather than popping open a canister of those sort of delicious but not very good for you things from the supermarket.
I don't even understand fried onions in a can. I mean, I think I've used just about everything in a can, but fried onions in a can, I just would never even think to look for it.
It is a sort of macabre thing, the idea, but they are also. I have to confess, I do find them sort of delicious.
Really?
Now, a lot of people for Thanksgiving think one of the comfort foods for Thanksgiving is cranberry sauce with the imprint of the inside of the can.
Exactly. If it doesn't have that pattern, it's not Thanksgiving.
Exactly.
Right?
Remember, we went to a Thanksgiving dinner at a friend's house, and it was a dysfunctional family anyhow, and then they opened the can, pushed out this cranberry sauce, and then tried to get this round thing to be served at table rolling around on a flat platter. It was just unbelievable.
I don't know. I also have a kind of weird secret appreciation for that too, though.
Now, another wonderful thing about this book is these recipes were created by some of America's top chefs and cookbook authors, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these are great home cooks, but some of those people like Nancy Harmon Jenkins are great home cooks too.
Yes, that's right.
Are there any recipes that you contributed yourself, James?
There are about two or three. Probably the favorite recipe that I contributed was, it's on page 128. It's Indonesian chicken curry, inspired by a recipe that was in that book that I'd written when we last spoke, Cradle of Flavor.
Great.
Classic Javanese chicken curry with coconut milk and flavored with a lot of ginger and coriander seeds and lime leaves and lemongrass.
Yeah, it looks great.
It's heaven. It's just, the dish is just absolute heaven.
Now, you also include very, very, at various levels here, writings by contributors to the magazine. So there's high-quality writing going along with various functions, describing dishes or talking about artichoke types or that sort of thing. And then you also have some vintage photographs. And I like the photographs you have of native. I mean, like I'm looking at this wonderful woman making the wild greens pie.
Oh, yes.
Or to Peter. I mean, the people themselves look so authentic.
Well, they are. They're just regular old home cooks like you and I. In fact, that woman that you're referring to, our executive food editor shot that sequence of images in central Greece last summer. It was a home cook that Todd had found through an old college friend of mine, a Greek college friend of mine,
uh-huh.
who's a family friend, and she made this beautiful, beautiful wild greens pie, not just spinach. In fact, I don't think it has any spinach in it at all, but instead fennel and mint and, it's just beautiful.
We should try that. We have all that kind of junk growing in the garden.
Yeah. I think our gardener thought I was, we're interviewing a new gardener, and I think he thought I was totally crazy because he was going to pull out some of these weeds, and I said, no, that's for our salad.
Well, yes.
I mean, it was wood soil. I mean, it was beautiful wood soil, and he was going to.
No, I'm going to say it on the air with James Osland as a witness. You're trying to poison me with all this stuff.
Oh, no, I would be there. I would eat that.
You would be there.
Those are my favorite foods on earth.
Give us your mailing address. We'll send you some.
Now, this photograph of illustrating the French onion soup is pretty wonderful, too. Now, that's a vintage photo, isn't it? It's taken in Au Pied de Cochon.
That's right, a restaurant that was in the former. I never say this right. Do you say Layal or Layzal?
Yeah,
I think you actually say Layal.
Yeah, I mean, it should be Lezal, but it isn't for some reason. Only the French would understand.
Exactly.
I mean, it's near the cathedral called Saint Eustace, and it's a concrete wasteland. Mostly.
Right. Yeah.
But some of the restaurants stayed there. I think we've eaten at this one, Au Pied de Cochon.
That's right. And this restaurant, I don't know if I'm contradicting myself, but indeed this restaurant is still there and still serving this very, very splendid French onion soup.
Yeah, there's a row of restaurants all with an association with very traditional French, I think a lot of it from the Lyon region.
Right.
That just sort of hung on there. And the tourists find them, so they continue to stay there.
Now, James, tell me this: you've done a lot of this investigating of food, and mm-hmm. and you're exposed to all this stuff. What is there some common denominator to what makes a dish a comfort food?
Well, I think maybe as I was sort of referencing earlier, I think that all these comfort food dishes, they share kind of directness. These are not fancy dishes. These are not dishes that, you know, take the palate any time to, you know, decipher or make sense out of. They're just sort of immediately, like, to the gut satisfying. They're also, by and large, not difficult dishes to make. I think that, you know, if a dish is going to take hours and hours and 89 ingredients, it's probably not going to be a comfort food dish. It's going to be another kind of. And I think also, Peter, you just hit on it a few minutes ago when you were talking about that. I think that all of these dishes, every last one of them, there's some sort of resonance in them as far as some sort of memory. It could be a very individual private memory, but usually they're sort of larger cultural memories that all of these dishes have. Somehow associated with them.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. But one of the neat things that you've done with this book is you've actually introduced the concept of comfort foods and applied it to cuisine around the world.
Right.
Not just the macaroni and cheese and things like
right.
that are considered comfort foods in the United States.
Right.
So there's a great portfolio of recipes available for people who want to enjoy what comfort foods are like, but with a different accent, if you like, a different dialect, because they're from a different culture.
Right.
So we're going to make some of them for sure. And
who's going to make them?
Well, I am. I get to make most things these days.
You can make Lindy's cheesecake.
I can make Lindy's cheesecake. Yeah, well, I'm going to do the easy thing tonight. I'm going to make the Blue Ginger Chef. What's his name? I always get his name pronounced wrong. We're going to have...
Ming Sai.
We're going to have Ming Sai's seared tuna coated with crushed cardamom seeds.
Oh, that sounds very good.
Coriander seeds.
Coriander. I was going to say cardamom might be overbearing.
He serves his with some kind of mayonnaise, and I don't think we're going to do that. But that's dinner for tonight.
Okay, thank you.
Is that a comfort food? Probably not, but...
I don't know.
It's pretty good. I think for sure if it's coriander and not cardamom. But I think tomorrow night you should make one of the recipes from Sever.
All right. I have some lamb. So let me see what I can do with lamb.
Oh, there's a good lamb recipe in here. Yeah.
Great. So maybe I'll
7-hour leg.
Right. That in fact is actually the longest the recipe that will take the longest to make.
Yeah, well.
But it's not hard to make. You just throw everything in the pot and then it cooks. But
Well, James, again, wonderful talking to you.
Likewise.
And, and I enjoy hearing about your trips, like your most recent one to Brazil.
And keep up the great work in the magazine too. We love the barbecue issue. I wanted to tear some pages out of it, but then I realized I'd be tearing every page out of it. So I think we just kept the whole thing. So thank you so much for that and for the great work you're going to do in the future too.
Oh, thank you very much, you guys.
Okay, James. Ciao.
Bye.
And we'll be back after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. And next up, we have sort of a collection of articles and recipes that have appeared in Esquire, and the book is called Esquire's Eat Like a Man. And I think that those who explore this book will find some rather interesting recipes.
And it's a great complement to the comfort food book as well. Have both of them side by side. You won't be able to go far wrong in trying to decide what to have for dinner tonight.
As articles editor, I would say Ryan D'Agostino has a pretty hefty job at Esquire magazine. It's good to be talking to you, especially after you debuted this wonderful new book filled with wit and wisdom, the kind of thing you'd expect from Esquire magazine, called Eat Like a Man, the only cookbook a man will ever need. Welcome, Ryan.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, I looked at the title and I thought, I'm not going to do this. But then I realized what it was about, and it's a delightful, absolutely delightful book.
And we talked just before coming on the air, so you had an interesting explanation for why the book, because Eat Like a Man appears regularly in Esquire magazine in the print edition, of course, on the online edition, but you said there was a really unusual reason why you decided to publish it as a book.
Well, for one thing, I selfishly wanted to be able to have all these recipes at my fingertips at any time rather than going through all my old Esquires all the time. We hope that people tear out different things and save the issues of the magazines in pristine condition on the shelf, of course, but it's just not nice to have these recipes because every month, you know, we work so hard in the magazine to find the best chefs in the country, from the most famous names you could think of, the Mario Batalis and Tom Colicchios, to the sort of workaday chefs who are running their kitchens in Charleston and Portland, Maine, and different places like that where you may not have heard of them, but they're just fantastic and talented chefs. And so we find these people and we try to get their best out of them, not for their, they're not giving us recipes for the 4-star items on their menus or their signature dishes, because it didn't seem like that's the kind of food that people want to cook at home. We sometimes ask them, well, you know, what do you make for your wife or your kids or yourself, you know, at midnight, you know, what are you cooking? And we work with them to make sure that they're recipes for food that men want to eat and can cook.
So now all these, the whole book really is based on things that appeared in Esquire, but going back for how many years?
I would say good 5 or 6 years. We have been doing more and more food coverage in the magazine. And of course, it's been part of what Esquire has offered since the magazine was created in 1933, entertaining and making cocktails and being a good host, and it's always been sort of a part of the Esquire man, but more and more it seems like men are getting into the kitchen in this country. I don't think that's a fake trend. I think it really is happening, and maybe it started with the rise of food television and more guys watching that on TV, but it's also, it's just this discovery that I think guys are having that it not only is it kind of fun to get into the kitchen, because when I think most men cook, it's not, oh, I'm going to cook something on Tuesday night, throw something together for dinner. It's more recreation, and they do it as a project on an after Saturday afternoon or when they're having somebody over, a date or, you know, poker night or something. But it's also like kind of a primal instinct maybe where, you know, the man cooking the food and serving it to people who depend on him or like him. It's just, I think there's something very sort of masculine about doing that. And then, of course, you get all this praise and adoration from people, and of course men like that too.
And well, Tom Colicchio, who did the foreword, addresses this, takes platitudes associated with men and works them into how they apply to the book, such as men don't stop to ask for direction.
Exactly, it was really a genius way.
I thought so too.
To do the foreword, he takes these common assumptions about men, these sort of, some of them sort of derisive, and you know, men don't stop to ask for directions, but he turns them into positives in the kitchen. So when we don't ask for directions, that can be a detriment when we're late for the wedding and our our wife is telling us to pull over and at the gas station. But in the kitchen, it can really be an attribute because while recipes are sort of great, calls them at best case scenario, they're a great kind of jumping off point that can teach you how to do something. But I think ultimately what you want to do is to be able to go into any kitchen and cook anything, which is something it's like what I'm always trying to do is to be that guy who can just show up at someone's house and cook. And so with these recipes, we really try to get the chefs to put in their in each one some kind of tip or technique or something they're teaching you, maybe not overtly, maybe you don't even realize it, that you're picking up this skill. But like as you cook your way through the book, you're kind of building on the skill set so you can cook anything.
Well, I like your entry altogether. You actually walk around with a recipe for pancakes in your pocket.
I do. It's just, you wouldn't believe how kind of cool it is when you're a house guest, and for me it's pancakes, but when you can just kind of, when there's a meal that needs to be cooked or no, we don't know what to have for lunch, like you can offer up your services, and it's just better than bringing a bottle of wine or something, one of those, or some soap, you know, some sort of house guesty sort of gift. But when you can make something from scratch, it's a great gift. And so I like to make, you know, these pancakes that my dad used to make for us growing up, but I could never, you know, you can't really play around too much with the measurements, so I would carry around this little piece of paper in my wallet, and lo and behold, you know, my host would wake up and I've got these pancakes made from scratch, and almost everyone has the stuff you need for pancakes, so it's just an easy way to impress people.
Now, it's interesting, you talk about avoiding the necessity to go back rooting through your old Esquire magazines, but what happens around here is the master of the house, who happens at this point to be doing most of the cooking as well, actually tears the magazines up and retains just the pages that are needed, and then we have this really ungainly pile of recipes which are in among the cigar boxes where the seeds for the gardener are kept. And sometimes it's necessary to go through the pile from the top to the bottom to find the one you're looking for.
Absolutely, but then you always discover things you forgot you had.
Well, the ones we like are on the top. So things like the veal and chicken burgers from the low butcher shop up on 86th and Madison, that's close to the top.
Yeah.
We just discovered.
Was that from Esquire?
No, I forget where it was from.
Sounds good, though.
No, it wasn't. There aren't a lot in there from Esquire. I'm going to have to study this book really carefully.
Well, now you can just see it's all right here.
It's right here.
Yeah, exactly. I'm going to cut.
But you never did tell me, how am I going to get a whirly popper? I thought that was hysterical.
What's a whirly popper?
A whirly popper.
I don't even know what a whirly popper is.
In among, they have a section on some tools you'll need.
Okay.
And then there's a big box article called the Whirly Popper by Scott Robb.
It's a great home popcorn making device, because no one should be making microwave popcorn at home, I don't think. And it's popcornpopper.com. It's an ode to, we have this equipment section, which is called Some Tools You'll Need, because, you know, men like tools, of course, so anything about that, hopefully they'll read. And it's not much, you know, it's some pots and pans, and you got to have good knives and.
And music.
I thought that was an essential tool, so. And then we threw in for fun our little endorsement of the Whirly Popper popcorn maker.
They still make that, huh? They still make the Whirly Popper. I'm going to request one.
Yeah, absolutely.
They ask for one of those.
You got to get one. $25.
Now, would you say in general, Ryan, that your focus is on what you might call manly or masculine recipes?
Yeah, but we try to define that. We don't really define it. So it's not all what you might think. There's plenty of meat in this book, to be sure. I mean,
that's what I was thinking. That's literally the point I was making.
Steak recipes and giant roasts and things like that, which might be the first things you think about when you're thinking about eating like a man, and they should be in here. And they're sort of what I think are some of the best treatments of those dishes that I've ever cooked at home. But we try to broaden it. You know, we set the book up, we organize it by breakfast, lunch, and dinner, because I'm a kind of regular guy who's trying to learn to cook using cookbooks. And the way I do it is it's whatever meal I feel like, what do I want to make? I want to make some breakfast. I want to make lunch or dinner. And that's how I kind of search for recipes. So we broke it up that way. It seemed logical. And then really, we just asked the chef, you know, give us a recipe for men. And we try not to put too many parameters on it beyond that. And most of the chefs in the book are men. We have some women, of course, who are great at feeding men. But you have things like a chicken parm hero with a sausage tomato sauce. We have a tuna melt that will just blow away your idea of what it means to make a great tuna melt. Calls for you to make your own mayonnaise, which sounded daunting to me, and my initial reaction to the chef was, oh, we can't do that. That sounds too hard and fussy. I mean, of course, it takes about 2 minutes, and it's delicious. So
you should point out that all these people are really great chefs.
Oh, great, great chefs. I mean, and again, some of the ones you've heard of, you got your Mario Batali and Michael Mina, who's got restaurants all over the place. But then
Thomas Keller.
Thomas Keller, of course, is
Michael White.
One of the masters. Michael White is amazing.
He just opened in someplace, Hong Kong.
Hong Kong, he's got a new restaurant there. But then, you know, you have some of these guys like Sean Brock in Charleston, who is just an...
Oh, I love Sean.
I mean, I think you're going to be hearing a lot more about him in the next few years, don't you?
Oh, he's already won the Beard Award.
We discovered him about 6 years ago.
Yeah, he's fantastic.
And he's still young. I mean, he's over 30 now.
And he's still growing. I mean,
he's just opened, I think, his second place. I mean, I hope.
Yeah, we've been there, too. It's really good.
It's fabulous.
But, you know, you have Kevin Davis in Seattle and a guy named Billy Grant up in Hartford and Evan Funky at this great place, Rustic Canyon, out in Santa Monica.
Yeah, that one I don't know. Yeah.
He's great, and it's a great recipe. So we have this woman who's been writing about food for Esquire for, I don't know, over a dozen years, named Francine Maruk. And Francine has, dedicated her life to finding these chefs out there, and chefs who are just intensely personal about their food and can tell you stories. And if she asks a chef to, you know, tell me about where this dish came from and it takes him more than 5 minutes, he's off her list. Forget it. And if he needs too many publicists to help him craft his message, he's off her list. So she's really always out there looking for the real thing. And it really shows through in the recipe. So even if she's working with a famous chef like Michael Simon from Cleveland or Eric Repair or Danielle Ballou or Charlie Palmer, she's going to get it out of them. But, you know, they're sort of personal stories about where the dishes came from. But she's even at her best when she's out there in the smaller restaurants or the places where it's these real workaday chefs who are in their kitchens every night, and she's going to get just amazing recipes for the home cook.
Well, I wanted to ask about the photographs. Are they new, current, made for the book, or are they also photographed for the magazine?
It's kind of amazing. They actually were all from the magazine, which was a concern because we thought, well, you know, we use some different photographs, different months, depending on what we're shooting. But I feel, of course I'm biased, but because we try to keep the aesthetic in Esquire pretty consistent, they all sort of feel like they belong, and I think they hang together. I don't think there are too many that look wildly out of place.
And Mario Batali, that's why I ask, because he looks a lot thinner, and he hasn't had a dirty apron for a long time.
Well, we set that one up as a funny shot. It's him, picture him flipping burgers in a diner, which I think is great. And I should say he's lost something like, I don't know, 50 pounds lately or something.
Yeah, he's much
thinner. Looking better, but yeah, that's I don't know, a few years ago. But the food shots are all photographed exclusively for Esquire, and I hope they look delicious.
Oh, they do. They look wonderful.
There's one here of an almost empty plate.
Yeah, good.
can't get back to it now.
No, I mean...
That one right there.
Right.
What's bone-in top loin and somebody...
And that's Michael Mina.
That's a great recipe.
And Ryan ate most of it while it was being shot.
I did. I couldn't help myself. That's all we had left.
Well, I think this is an accomplishment. And I mean, there are recipes in here that we're going to use. So, and we don't save old magazines. We've moved too many times.
Yeah, of course.
After a while, you don't do that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So.
No, but there's some, I've been cooking from this, of course I've cooked everything in the book because I wanted to make sure that kind of a, regular guy with decent but not great cooking skills, and I have a tiny kitchen in New York City, and so I wanted to make sure that our sort of regular guy with a regular kitchen, with kind of a regular arsenal of kitchen tools, which is to say not very expensive, could make everything in the book. And I could, and I think everyone could. We'd go to the measure of grading each recipe for difficulty.
Yeah, I saw that.
So the easy ones are easy. The medium ones we call reasonable. And then the ones that are, maybe require a little more time and effort, we say it's worth the effort. So even those are, That's the thing about cooking is any one task, if you break a recipe down, nothing is that difficult. It's the coordination and the planning and thinking it out. But we set up this index in the back of the book where you can look up all the recipes by difficulty level. So if you just want to, make something easy, great. But if you're into kind of setting aside some time and mixing yourself a drink and doing a little cooking, you can do that too.
Now, well, listeners, just before we go, let's make sure that people understand. Obviously, they can get this book, which is called
Esquire, Eat Like a Man.
But more importantly, with a subscription to Esquire magazine, they can stay up to date. They won't have to wait for the second volume to come out.
That's right. So, absolutely. The subscription is included with the price of the book.
There you go. Oh, is that right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, it
yeah.
is. I see it here now. Yeah, well, of course, we have a review copy, so we didn't get a subscription. We already have a subscription to Esquire.
I'm signed up for at least another 3 years, I think.
Excellent. Well, we appreciate
it. For the rest of your life, probably.
Ryan, thank
Ryan,
you so much.
It was great meeting you.
Yeah, oh, thank you.
Thanks for your great work and for joining us today on The Menu.
I appreciate it. Thank you both.
Thanks. Bye.
And don't go away, because we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Okay, sweetheart, what's up next?
Yes, well, I mean, there are a lot of books out there on butchering because it's a big hot topic of late. This one is written, however, by people who have long been iconic in the field, and it's called The Butcher's Guide to Well-Raised Meat. And we're going to be talking to Joshua Applestone. As I said, I mean, he is the name, the go-to in the field for butchering, artisanal butchering. So here he is.
I just found out that our two guests who are joining us now, Jessica and Joshua Applestone, I thought they were only proving their mental disease twice, but I just found out that it's a third time, because the first thing they started out with was they were vegans and then decided to become non-vegan. So that's craziness number one. Craziness number two, which probably occurred right around the same time, was why don't we start a butcher shop in this age of veganism? And then to go for triple trouble, they said, oh, and we've learned so much about it, we need to write The Butcher's Guide to Well-Raised Meat, which, of course, has a huge audience among those people who are vegetarians. Welcome to the program, and I know we're going to have some fun here.
Well, I want to point out one other thing before we ask them to give us their story is Applestone is Jessica's last name, right, Jessica?
That's correct.
And Joshua's family name was Fleischer. The name
That's correct.
The name of your butcher shop, which, in fact, means butcher.
Yes, ma'am.
And you're third generation, skipping your parents' generation, a third generation butcher. So that helps to explain a little bit, right?
Yes, exactly.
Well, let's jump back in time. First of all, this is a phenom right now in the food revolution in America. Butchering is. I just read, actually, that the founder of Facebook is practicing veganism, except when he kills his own animals. And
we actually welcome him to come on by the shop and take the course. We run a butcher school. We'd love to show him actually how to process the stuff he's killing.
Yeah, well, I thought it was kind of strange that he was doing this, but, I mean, it's not like he doesn't have a lot of other stuff
so,
to do.
So not like he's not strange.
Yeah, that's true, too. But you were at the forefront of all of this, sort of the granddaddy of your generation's returning to butchering. Explain exactly what was going on.
Well, I was a vegetarian and Josh was vegan when we met, but I was interested in eating meat again. I don't think it had occurred to Josh at that point. But when I decided to sort of explore my options, we live in upstate New York, which you would think would be sort of the perfect place to find sustainably, locally, well-raised meat. It was not. I couldn't go into a supermarket and find anything. And when I went to farmers locally, they wanted to sell me a side of beef or a quarter, and that was too much for me, eating meat alone, basically, in the house. So I was at a loss, and I turned to Josh one day, and I said, isn't there just someplace I could buy a lamb chop and have somebody tell me how to cook it? And he said, no, I can't believe that there isn't. And it was really important to us that our meat, that the meat that I was eating, or important to me, was ethically and sustainably raised, that it was well-raised meat, and that it was humanely slaughtered, and that it was raised locally. And he said, I can't believe that doesn't exist. And sort of based on that comment, we started Fleischer's, and it's been going from there. We had no idea what we were doing at first and what we were getting into. Josh, as he said, is a third-generation butcher. But that didn't translate into the actual skills of butchery for either of us. Certainly, he was a chef before that, and he certainly knew how to cut up meat, but not to break down sides the way old-fashioned butchers did, the way his great-grandfather or grandfather might have. Once butchery became a commercial operation dealing with commercial packing houses, that skill was generally lost.
Now, what do you get as your raw material? Are you getting sides from a packing house, or are you actually getting whole animals from the farmer?
Everything, as far as the United States is concerned, everything has to be what we call federally processed, federally killed, has to come out of a USDA slaughterhouse. We get our pigs, depending on the size, either split or whole with head off or head on. Lambs come whole, head on. Beef comes in quarters.
Okay, so that's just the rules.
That's the sizes we handle. We only purchase whole animals. We only get whole animals. We get nothing in a box. That's the motto. That's the law of the store.
Well, supermarkets and butcher shops in general, however, do not get that these days. They get prepackaged, either portion cut or a little bit larger pieces of meat.
We, for years now, have dealt with organic lamb growers. And this one in particular, for years I would buy the whole lamb, and I would get the innards and the offal. And, in fact, he would give me extra offal because nobody else wanted it.
Yeah, we definitely have our customers that will take certain parts other people don't want. But really, in the end, you know, with a sustainable butcher shop that purchases whole animals, we have to have uses for everything. And we really do. We have a great program where very little ever gets wasted.
Well, they told me that I could no longer get my lamb livers and lamb kidneys because that it's viewed as floor kill by the USDA inspectors.
They call it drop weight. What it is that you just have to have people at your slaughterhouse care enough to take it and not let it get, you know, thrown into what they would call the gut bucket, if you would, just to be, like, you know, really harsh about it, which is that, you know, it's just a matter of where stuff gets processed out of the animal and drops onto the floor. They put it right into a gut bucket, which goes into rendering, rather than trying to select out parts that people really want. You know, we're in a different day and age, and a lot of them are just not used to that type of demand. It's coming back, though. It's nice to see.
Yeah, but, I mean, is it a matter of money like everything else is? You have to pay somebody extra to do that.
We pay for them, but also, you know, the guys that we use own different farms. One of the slaughterhouses we use is almost owned by a collective. So it's, you know, everyone is vested in making sure that we use everything that we can.
Are you kosher, your shop?
No, ma'am.
Because that's another thing that's on the rise.
We are going to be doing a kosher place eventually, but that's like down the road. It's just a matter of really taking it one step at a time and really making sure we're making correct, logical decisions the whole way. We have a lot of plans. It's just important to take, not necessarily baby steps, but we're on the front line of this. And a lot of stuff we do, a lot of people have their eyes on us. And we'd like to make sure that we encourage by verbal and by action. We're on projects that we can be successful at that we find that we're not overextending ourselves. So it's all a matter of time.
Now, before we came on the air, we were bemoaning the fact, Anne was bemoaning the fact that the butcher that we used to have, that we went to for the first 20 years, I guess, we lived in Pittsburgh, lost his lease and didn't bother to reopen in another location. And it's not clear to me that I know where we could go for a butcher shop like yours.
There is not one.
In Pittsburgh, I mean,
can go to the farmers. You can go to the farmers market. You can order from the farmers and collect it.
Yeah, I mean,
that's
the farmers at the firehouse. But you can't go and look at, like, a whole display of stuff and say, yes, I've decided I want this today.
No. But, I mean, what we've done is we joined four other people and bought a fifth of a cow that was humanely raised.
Yeah, but you can't do that every day. I mean, it would be nice to be able to go to
it. And then it ends up freezing.
I said it would be nice to be able to go to a butcher shop like Fleischer's.
Sure.
And be able to look at what they have today and say, now I see behind the counter, now I know what I'd like to get.
Right.
Sort of like the fish counter at Whole Foods is sort of like that. I mean, they have 12 or 15 different varieties that are in there that day, and I can pick one. And I can't really do the same with meat because they don't have all the same kind of interesting cuts. Now, here's the question I was going to ask. I mean, is there an organization that you belong to that we could go to that's called the Independent Butchers of America and we could find out where their places are?
Unfortunately, there isn't. There are organizations that are starting that represent butchers, but the reality is that there are so few butchers left, really old school butchers. But the good news is that more and more butcher shops are opening up and more people are starting to learn this craft again. It really is a dying art, and it's very important that people realize that it is an art and a skill that takes many years to learn, and that it isn't just something, it isn't just a clerk at a supermarket opening up a package and cutting a steak. There's much more to it than that. So there are a lot of people that are interested. We have an apprenticeship program, as Josh had said, that goes for 8 weeks and teaches the art of butchery, and that is always filled. We always have someone, at least one apprentice in the shop. We call them apprentices. We have apprentices that are starting their own shops. We have two in L.A. We have someone that's coming up that's going to be starting his own shop in Westport, Connecticut. So there's a movement afoot, and there is definitely hope. That
and more women, too, are joining in, right?
A lot of women, because butchery isn't just about strength and lifting. It's also about finesse and being able to have good cutting skills, good knife skills, which you don't have to be a 6'5" burly guy. It helps, though. I mean, the reality is that it is a demanding job, and most of the men who work in my shop are able to lift enormous pieces of meat off the table or, you know, off of hooks, and I couldn't do the same. So
now, how would you think that, you know, I guess there are two classes of people who are listening now, those who are fortunate enough to have a butcher like Fleischer's and those who don't. For those who have the opportunity to go to a craft butcher, this book is immensely valuable because it sort of levels the playing field, if you like. Assume that between every buyer and seller there's some kind of tension that exists, where the butcher would like to sell something and the purchaser of meat would like to buy something, and they're sort of in conflict over things like the price and how much that is needed and all that kind of stuff. So it seemed to me that it would be really handy to read this book really cover to cover, because it's just packed with really useful information. So
we like that, and, you know, we're strange in that we don't really feel like we're ever pushing meat. We're really pushing education. Probably the first people to say that we believe that Americans, and I know that this is a wider network listening, but we believe that Americans eat too much meat and that they should substantially cut their portion size. And we say it over and over and over again. And the other thing is that our friends in Europe and even in Canada are very blessed. They don't have the same lack of butcher shops that we do. You know, we have a lot of friends in Montreal, and we go up there, and we're just astounded by the amount of butcher shops there, charcuterie shops. People really take their food very seriously there, and in a very different way than we do in America. And it's a tragedy that we've lost that, and it's a tragedy that we've lost the art of shopping daily or every other day, that we sort of stock up for the week at a large supermarket, and, you know, we want our meat to last that long or 10 days. Really, food, vegetables, meat, fish certainly isn't meant to be kept that long. And so, you know, the idea of having a neighborhood butcher where you can, as you say, walk in and buy a piece of meat and haggle with the butcher and talk about politics, and it's a really important thing.
I'm going to raise my hand because I do exactly what you just described almost every day. Now,
right.
The unfortunate thing is that the only place that's close enough for me to do that is Whole Foods, which is not exactly a butcher shop. But I do shop that way and find it much more interesting, and I don't want to have to think a week ahead about what it is that I'd like to get.
Let's talk about how else your book is different from the other books in this. It's very practical. It's filled with information and tips, things like fun things to do with pork fat, all different names you're using for castrated animals. What other things? What characterizes this book?
I think that the basic premise behind the book was to make meat accessible. We were really concerned with the fact that when people walk into a butcher shop, or even when they go to a counter at Whole Foods, very often they have one thing in mind because either they've read it in a cookbook and they don't dare try to get anything else because they don't know what to get, or they've that idea that this is the only thing that they can eat or make. And so what we've tried to do is sort of demystify meat buying a little bit, and not only meat buying, but being able to cook it and being able to understand where that piece of meat comes from on the animal. It's a really important process for us, and we've worked with our customers. We say that we spend 10 to 15 minutes with each of our customers because we are trying to almost train them to think about meat differently. All of our employees, as well as ourselves, have some sort of culinary background. And so when somebody comes in and they request a brisket and say we don't have it, because, again, we are a sustainable butcher shop, which means that sometimes we run out of things, and that's what you're looking for in a sustainable butcher shop. In other words, we can't just go in the back and open up a box of briskets. We have two briskets per animal, and that's it. We would encourage somebody to buy chuck, and expose them to other kinds of meat that could work just as well.
Yeah, what was it? Mario Batale wanted to buy from one of our lamb growers 300 lamb tongues a week. Because he used that lamb tongue salad in Baba's menu.
Yeah, I've heard that story before. I think most chefs go through that, and they always have that wonderful idea that, you know, they can use the offcuts, the offal, and it's great because the farmer's going to have this. And what I don't think they understand is if obviously they're getting 300 lamb tongues a week, that's quite a lot of lambs.
I thought, sweetheart, you were going to say that you were going to quote Mario in his cookbook where he says that he's so glad that they now sell parts of chicken rather than whole chickens because that means he doesn't have to throw the breasts away to the dogs. but you yourself say skinless, boneless chicken thighs are so superior to skinless, boneless chicken breasts. And we agree with you. We already knew that. So
that's a really basic thing. And I think it's just getting people out of their comfort zone and having them learn how to think about meat and products a little bit differently. We say, and this is just one of the common things, that we have every customer that comes in, no matter what they buy, they could be buying lamb's tongues or kidneys or the most obscure piece of beef, everybody buys chicken. And chicken's great. You know, there's nothing wrong with chicken, but people should know, one, how to cut up a chicken. They should know what the best taste is, perhaps, and how to flavorfully cook a chicken in a different way rather than just roasting it. So we give them sort of a spatchcock chicken recipe, a brick chicken recipe, which we love and we do at home. It's a really, really fast way to roast a chicken in a beautiful way.
And it's in the book, even photographs, so it looks delicious.
Yeah, it's amazing. And we do it in a cast iron pan. That's the other thing, is we try to get people to sort of look at the materials that they're using. So we have a whole equipment section. We talk about how the most important thing when you cook meat is not to judge it by time, but to judge it by temperature. And I think that's a real shock for most people, that they should really own a meat thermometer and that they should be judging things based on rareness, based on the temperature that they get when they insert the meat thermometer into the meat, rather than either feel or timing. We pretty much will not ever tell anyone how long to cook a steak. We always tell them to look at a temperature guide, which we have in the book as well. For my mother, who's been a cook her entire life, and as I said earlier, has a butcher herself, one of the things that she found really interesting was how to store meat and how long it can stay and how to keep it, how to freeze meat and how to wrap it. That sort of thing was really interesting to her. And we always suggest that when you buy a steak that you loosen the wrappings around it and you place it on a plate so that the air can circulate and so it's not sort of sitting in its own juices. And it doesn't dry age it, of course, but it just dries it out a little bit. But that's fine rather than it getting sort of slimy and wet and nasty. And she was so excited about that, and she's been drying her meat that way, storing her meat that way ever since. So it's pretty funny what different people get from the book.
I think it's an amazingly useful book for anyone who's not a vegan or a vegetarian, The Butcher's Guide to Well-Raised Meat. And we hope that, first of all, we wish you every success at Fleischer's. We hope that someday you'll come across the name of a butcher like yourself somewhere in western Pennsylvania that we can use. And we wish you well. I'm sure that book will have the success it deserves. And thank you so much for joining us on the menu.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
And we'll be back after a short commercial break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, back again, and this time we're going to take even beyond this butchering up your own meat.
Well, there is some butchering in there too.
Yeah, but
first you have to catch it or find it
or shoot it.
I guess you're not allowed to grow it. In the book, hunt, gather, cook. Hank Shaw will tell us all about it.
And he has, of course, his website is Hunter Gatherer Cook, so okay. I get them confused sometimes, but it's the book we're going to be talking about.
Well, we're going to be talking about his views on the whole world of what it's like to forage, what it's like to live closer to the land, all that kind of good stuff.
I actually think it must have been rather frustrating to be a hunter and gatherer and have to chase after things and throw stones at them or whatever you had to do to stop something in its tracks so you could kill it and eat it. But
I don't know that it's that frustrating. I think hunting and fishing is one of the most hopeful things that we do.
There you go. So Hank Shaw, who just completed a book called Hunt, Gather, Cook, has a different point of view.
And its subtitle, which I think is a big part of his point, Finding the Forgotten Feast. And I think that's what your motive is in this, isn't it, Hank?
It is. I mean, one of the things that I'm trying to do is remind people that we used to have a much more diverse diet than we do today. And one of my goals in life is to encourage people to eat little of a lot as opposed to a lot of a little. And by eating more and unusual foods, both wild and domestic, I think that goes a long way to that. And all you really have to do is look not too far in our own past here in America to get to that kind of a place where salsify and cardoons and pigeons and boar and wild game were much more mainstream than they are today.
How long have you been actually doing
this? Well, it depends on what this is. I've been foraging and fishing since I was a little boy.
Yeah, you didn't.
I did not pick up hunting until I was 32.
Oh, right. But now, I love the fact that your mother taught you how to fish.
she's a Yankee from Ipswich, Massachusetts. So,
okay.
Yeah, I come by it honestly.
Yeah, well, she used to catch those fish sticks, right?
Yeah, right.
she used to catch fish fingers.
You know.
In fact, she does live in Gloucester right now, home of the Gordon Fisherman.
Oh, really? Well, I was asking how long you've been doing this in the sense of, I don't know. I mean, you are a journalist. You've worked in kitchens, so you're a cook as well. But I'm trying to get some idea of, this is now a really big trend, but have you been always aware of this, or is it just coming stronger into your consciousness because of Michael Pollan and all the stuff we've been hearing about this foraging?
Well, I mean, everything that I've been doing, it predates Michael Pollan's book by, you know, decades or more.
Okay, so you really are a born and trained forager.
Yeah, I've been doing it since I said I was a little boy. And but what Pollan's book has really been helpful for is it's allowed me to give to a skeptic a book that says, you know, say, here, read this. And they read it, and they said, oh, I get it now. You're Angelo from that third part of Michael Pollan's book. I'm like, yeah,
oh, yeah,
that's basically
right.
What I do.
Right.
And that book has been enormously influential with other people, and it's been enormously helpful for people like me because it makes sense of what we do, which to people who might think of hunting as something, you know, alien or even barbaric, and that book has helped a lot of people say, hey, I get it now.
The greed stuff, greens and plants and stuff, I deal with actually much better than I deal with gutting a shot buck.
It's a nasty business, that's for sure.
I mean, got like, that, you know? Yeah. I don't physically think I could do that anyhow.
Well, not everybody has to. It is where meat comes from. There's been hunters and non-hunters as long as there have been, so it's just, it is something that a lot of us choose to do because we want to know where our meat comes from, and we want to, you know, there's a lot of people I've met very recently, actually, who say that if they don't have the intestinal fortitude to actually do that, then they have no business eating meat. Now, I don't know that I necessarily agree with that, but I certainly understand it.
Almost all the food people I know have had a shot at slitting the throat of chicken.
Well, chicken's not exactly an 8-point buck.
No, but I'm saying that this is the kind of experience that everybody feels obligated to accumulate at this point.
Well, I liked his story about the pheasant, where he was honest enough to say that he went shooting with his friend, and his friend shot the limit of 3 each day, and he didn't get any. And then Hank, I guess, your friend gave you 3 of his, and then you had to figure out what to do with it, and that wasn't a very pleasant experience.
Why?
No, that first time was definitely a stopper. I mean, I had to sort of physically say, well, look, these pheasants died so that we can eat them. And I know once I wash them, they'll be fine. But boy, that initial smell and the guts don't really bother me because I've been fishing my whole life. So, you know, I'm used to fish guts.
Man.
But animal guts, sort of land animal guts or bird guts, the animal itself is much warmer. And that, you'd be surprised at how much affects the way you think about something, because can be other because fish are cold, but mammals and birds are warm like we are, and it touches a different part of us.
I was intrigued by your, I'll tell you this, and then my big question is something else. I was intrigued when you said the proper way to hang and age birds was with the feathers on and the guts in. And, you know, I always wondered, because if you go to all the French markets in Paris, the birds always had their feathers on, and I didn't know why. But now all of a sudden, I think the EU has come in, and you don't see the birds with feathers anymore.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. The EU is doing a lot to damage traditional foodways in Europe. And
see, I thought it was for show, to show how fresh the thing was. But you say absolutely the opposite. It's just the proper way to make it taste good.
Right. There's a couple of things that are going on. I mean, one of them is the feathers preserve the suppleness of the skin. And so when they end up plucking the bird in the end, the skin's not all dried out. And so that's why they do that. For the feathers, and they keep the guts in because it's essentially controlled rot. I mean, it's not a hell of a lot different from dry-aged beef.
Yeah, or jugged hair. I mean, I always thought that jugged hair, and then that national dish of Korea, that gets a stench, doesn't it, with the meat?
Oh, yeah, I know that dish. Yeah, I forget the name of it, but it's sundae, I think it is.
Yeah, I had it, and I couldn't hardly get past the smell.
It tastes good. It's just sort of, you have to... It's no more shocking a smell than stinky cheese.
I guess so. What I want to say about this is, do you think that you wrote this book to encourage diversity in eating and so forth, but do you think that people are actually going to be able to pick up and start doing this as a result of this book?
I hope so. The reason I wrote especially that third part about hunting. I mean, there's lots of foraging books, but there really are very, very few books written in the English language that help adults get into hunting and fishing. Most books are aimed at children, or they are so filled with jargon, and they assume that you know so much that they're completely opaque to a beginner, even a smart beginner. So, yeah, I mean, I wrote it specifically so that if you are interested in fishing or hunting and you've never done this before, or if you know how to fish for something but not something else, or you maybe know how to basically hunt something but you've never hunted another animal that I cover in the book, that this book will give you that ability to take those first steps. Now, it's not, I mean, if you're an experienced deer hunter and you read my deer hunting section, you may get some value out of it for, you know, the recipes and for handling the game once it's down on the ground. But tips on helping people get started are just that. They're helping people get started, and they're not for advanced hunters. But, yeah.
It's scary, too, though, because, I mean, you're talking about this. This is mild stuff, this foraging for plants, and you're talking about how good daylilies are. And then you say, but watch out, if they're purple, they're blue. There are irises, which are toxic, and don't get Easter lilies because they're deadly. This, a little bit of information like this might be very dangerous to the general population.
Well, it's only as dangerous as people decide to make it. It's no more difficult to tell the difference between a daylily and an Easter lily than it is between a cabbage and a head of lettuce.
Uh-huh, that's,
I mean, if you had never seen the two, you'd think that a head of iceberg lettuce and a head of cabbage would look exactly the same, because they are very similar. But you can spot the difference between the two probably at 20 feet. And if you decide to eat daylilies, it is incumbent on you to know the difference between a daylily and an Easter lily at 20 feet.
Except it scares me to know, to realize how much I don't know.
Yeah, but it's especially important because you know not to shoot an iris. Because it's sort of a waste of ammo.
Well, I think you say that because bird identification is extremely important for hunting any bird. There's a lot of birds that look like other birds, and we hear stories every season of inexperienced hunters shooting the wrong bird, and they pay a hefty fine for it.
Okay.
So yeah, ID is important, especially considering, you know, here an example, pheasant hunting. You can only shoot the roosters. You can't shoot the hens. And you have to, that requires you to be disciplined enough to, when the bird flushes, to wait for that second to spot the bird, whether it's got a long tail and is brightly colored or not, because they look very different. But it takes that second of recognition before you pull the trigger that you must do as a hunter. And if you don't, you're poaching. And, you know,
what about swans?
Swans are legal to hunt in only a very few states because there's a number of different species of swans, including an endangered one. And, like, for example, we can't hunt them in California because we have lots of different kinds of swans, and one of which is endangered. You can hunt them in North Carolina. You can hunt them in Nevada, in Montana.
You can't hunt them in England because they all belong to the Queen.
That's true. The Queen actually eats, the queen actually eats one for Christmas dinner, from what I understand.
I never heard of that. Did you have it?
I think that's one of those apocryphal stories. I suspect that she probably eats chicken. But undoubtedly, Henry VIII ate swan.
Yeah, I guess
there wouldn't be much doubt about that. I don't think Queen Victoria probably didn't eat swan either.
You know, the other thing I think that's really important is your section here on the misfits.
Oh, I love that chapter. That's one of my favorite chapters.
Well, that's my favorite, too. Tell us about it.
Like I said, I've been fishing since I was a little kid, and my mom didn't have a lot of prejudices about fish growing up, but you'll find that most anglers do. Most anglers have
they're snotty, aren't they?
Yeah, what is good and what is not good.
Yeah.
And from a very early age, I learned that, well, why? One of those little kids would always ask why. And if you didn't have a good answer, you know, I would take the fish anyway. And then when I got a little older, in high school and in college, I started to ask the fishermen around me who would keep the fish that I would normally keep. So, well, why do you keep that? I'm like, oh, it's good for soup, or oh, it's good if you, you know, fry it this way, or it's good. I learned so much from other cultures. Like, this is the story of the old black guy who taught me about oyster toads that I have in the book. And I would never have known about that fish if I hadn't been sitting next to the guy. And I hadn't had the wherewithal to ask him. And just, it's interesting how we decide what is good and what is not good to eat. And fish is a very, very stark example of that. And I had made a point of focusing on the misfits, because some of them are much better tasting than the so-called glamour fish if you know what to do with them. I mean, the blowfish is a classic example. Blowfish are one of the finest eating fish in the ocean.
Yeah, well, of course, the story goes on that way about the sea cucumbers in Spain as well. The fishermen kept them for themselves. And then once somebody discovered that, then the price soared. They're very expensive.
Well, I've never eaten one.
Oh, that's good. What are they called?
They're called espardenyas.
Espardenyas in Spain.
And they just eat. There's only a small amount of the creature is actually edible, and then the fishermen just throw the rest over the side.
But they used to keep this for themselves until some great marketing genius realized how good they were.
Well, sea urchins used to be ridiculously cheap, and so the fishy trade became very, very popular in the United States.
Lobsters used to be given away, wasn't it?
Well, lobsters are weird, because they used to be a peasant food, and then they got expensive, and people suspect that the decline of the codfish in New England has allowed the lobster population to soar.
Oh, okay.
And in recent years, the price of lobster has gone way down, which I think is interesting.
Yeah, it's back up right here, but I don't know. You've pointed out something else. It's really important. You have a great overview, a grasp of the whole ecological state and the state of our ecology, because when you start interfering in any way in nature, you've got to have balance, perspective, or you're going to do more harm than without doing anything.
Exactly. I mean, it's not an easy jigsaw puzzle. If you're going to mess with a puzzle by taking the piece out or adding another piece,
exactly.
It's not real easy to make that picture look right.
Right. I think we have to all go after those lionfish. Did you read, what's his name, Greenberg's?
I did, in Food and Wine.
Yeah, I loved it. Great.
Yeah, I have another friend who goes down there and spears them also, and they're apparently pretty tasty, but I don't know why they're not fishing them with bait. Maybe they don't take bait, but they always seem to go down and spear them, and I'm not sure why.
Yeah, they're very evasive, apparently. They're very smart. Oh, nature, indeed. Well, I'm glad that you produced this book, Hank Shaw, because it makes everybody think about it, and I think we all should.
Yeah, well, I hope people read it, and I hope people, you know, get something out of it. I mean, the most thing I do, what I hope people do, is I hope people just think when they read the book. And even if they only go, like you said, like in your own backyard and forage for greens that are there, I think that's more than a start. I think that's an important beginning step, and it's just a recognition of the world around us. And my goal is that people will live more in the world instead of just on it. And
what should I do with my pesky squirrels? Should I shoot them?
Only if you're going to eat them.
Well, yeah, I told you before that I have this thing about eating rats, and I think they're rats, so I'm not sure I could eat them.
I won't shoot anything that I won't eat. So that's where I stand on that.
Okay, but if you had in your backyard had squirrels that were pesky, would you shoot them and eat them?
Oh, yeah. At least it's legal. I mean, I'm not going to break the law, but, you know.
See, that's the other thing you have to know is hunting regulations are different every state to state, right?
Oh, yeah. Every state's different. And I provide some resources at the end of the book on wherever you are in whatever state. Here's some websites and things to get started.
Okay, well, let's recap this. It's Hank Shaw, and his book is Hunt, Gather, and Cook, Finding the Forgotten Feast. But I wanted to get in here also that you have a very important and popular website called...
We do. Hunter, Angler, Gardener, Cook.
And the URL to that?
It's honest-food.net.
Great. Well, I hope everybody takes a look at this to see what we're all talking about and what's going on in the world as we look back at our what we used to do, where we are now, and where we're going to go in the future.
Now it's time to get, and now it's time to go shoot a carrot.
Oh, Hank, good talking to you.
Good talking to you, too. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
And there you have On the Menu for July 17th, 2011. We hope we'll see you again, same time, same place, next week.
Bye-bye.